Okay, so thanks a lot, and in particular, thanks for the invitation and the opportunity to come here. It's a great place to discuss about physics. And so I want to take this opportunity and explain to you an approach to quantum gravity, which is quite non-standard. So it's quite different from all the sort of the main approaches which are on the market otherwise. I still think it is so. The reason why I do it is, of course, because I think it's the most promising one. So I will try to explain to you a little bit what's the idea and how to work with this and what to think about it. So this will be a very qualitative talk, and it's mainly about the structure, how all this geometric stuff is set up in the framework of matrix models, which is, of course, somewhat unusual compared to other approaches. So the title is... Or the aim is really to get something like emergent space-time. And gravity from matrix models. So matrix models I will always abbreviate like that. And I really have in mind 3+1 dimensions. Okay, so matrix models is something which is completely discrete in a sense, you know, you just have n times n matrices, and the question is, how can you describe something like manifolds? How can these geometric structures arise in a suitable sense? Now, some of you may be familiar with kind of, let me call it an old approach to matrix models, which was popular in the 80s, where people have used this to describe two-dimensional gravity by whatever, where geometry is then sort of built up from large Feynman graphs, so sort of a deep perturbation theory in certain critical matrix models. This is completely different from what I talk about today. So it's also completely different from the so this kind of approach is now also pursued in higher dimensions in groups for in places like France, Rivasoa, and so on. Again, completely different story. What I will talk about is some weakly coupled, only weakly quantum approach to manifolds, which are sort of close to classical as you may think of and as you may like. And so the question is, what's the mathematical framework to describe geometry? So let me first talk about that. What is the mathematical framework? And well, we want to talk about manifolds. Now, to describe a manifold, of course, we're not going to use a set of points, but we will describe manifolds through the space of functions on these manifolds, and we are completely used to that. That's what we always do in physics anyway. So field theory, you always talk about functions on a manifold. Coordinates are functions on a manifold, and so on and so forth. So this is completely standard. Now, to quantize manifolds or to quantize this thing somehow, we learned in quantum mechanics how to do that. Because in quantum mechanics, you talk about phase space, and then quantized phase space is described in terms of an operator algebra, which is an algebra of, let me think of it as algebra of matrices in some Hilbert space. So this will correspond to the algebra of matrices of some Hilbert space. And that's the basic thing to have in mind. And there should be a correspondence, which means there should be a quantization map or dequantization map, at least in some suitable regime, where you can replace classical functions of the manifold by matrices or operators, capital phi. And this can be made pretty explicit in various ways, at least in nice examples. Let me just stick to the generic picture here. And of course, there is one structure that you need here. So the manifold M is really a symplectic manifold for this to work. So this is symplectic. And the idea is, like always in quantum mechanics, you want to replace commutators in some suitable semi-classical regimes by Poisson brackets. So this is the guiding line. And Poisson bracket, of course, encodes the symplectic structure. And that's the kind of framework we have in mind. And we all know this very well. OK. So this is the setup. Now, one thing that's missing here is, of course, a metric. So to do gravity, we need a metric. How do you describe a metric here? And well, there are various things you might try, but the way which arises in the matrix model is as follows. You think of this manifold as being an embedded manifold. So how do you get a matrix? One way to get the metric is to think of this manifold as being a submanifold in some target space. And this target space has a metric, for example, the constant Minkowski metric. So there is a target space. This is RD. You have coordinate functions on this target space, and somehow, somewhere here is your manifold. Okay. Now, and if you have sort of a submanifold in target space, of course, this manifold somehow inherits some metric structure from target space, one way or the other. And to make this more explicit, the embedding is defined in terms of embedding map. This embedding map is just, you know, just defined by the Cartesian coordinate functions on target space, which now you consider as functions on the manifold. So these are functions. Now we learned that we can quantize functions, so we can replace functions by operators, by matrices. So let's do that. And let me define. So these are going to be the objects in the matrix model. Let me define a couple of matrices, capital X. So this is kind of the quantization of these embedding functions. So these are matrices. And you have D matrices. And that means, yes, what's the question? Yes.
Are they fixed, the cubes?
Sorry?
Are the cubes fixed?
I do not understand. Are the cubes fixed? Yeah, let me assume I have a specific manifold, which is where already I know how to quantize it. Of course, I can explain this, I can make this more explicit later, but let's assume for the moment that we have a manifold and we know how to quantize it, and then I can do that.
Any question? What is omega for you?
Yeah, omega is a simplectic structure. Yeah, suppose you have some. Okay, let me just assume we have a simplectic structure. In our example, actually, it will work the other way around. In a matrix model, we start with the matrices, and then this kind of will emerge in the other limit. But to get the geometric picture, let me present it like that. So let's assume we have this thing, a simplectic structure, we know how to quantize, and then we can define these matrices. The point I want to make is, now, so the information or the structure of a manifold will be now encoded in a matrix configuration. So what is a matrix configuration? That's a basic object here, matrix configuration. This is nothing but a set of D Hermitian matrices. A goes from 1 to. So a set of such matrices, so all these matrices are assumed to be Hermitian. This is what I call a matrix configuration. And this is the data which matrix models talk about. So these are the degrees of freedom in a matrix model. And the way to think of geometry is some given set of Hermitian matrices describes a manifold. That's how you think about this. This is kind of the most important thing. If this is not vaguely clear, then maybe we should discuss it more. So I will now, in the following, we will discuss about properties and more details about such matrix configurations as they are governed by a matrix model. And the intuition to have in mind is this one. So you think of matrices, specific sets of matrices, as describing a quantized embedding of some manifold in target space, and therefore there will also be some kind of a metric structure, which I'll make more explicit in a second.
So Okay. Classically, you've got M and the map of M into RD.
Yeah.
And then you quantize both M and RD?
No. RD is just, that's just the classical picture you have in mind. RD doesn't really exist. It's just encoded because I have a set of D matrices, so I picture it in terms of this. This is the classical picture to get an intuition. RD will not really, that's the only thing you have. These are the configurations to play with, a set of D Hermitian matrices. And you know, to make any picture of it, think of it like that. Okay? So, okay, let me actually give an example, of course. You know, the simplest example is what is known as a Meyer-Weil quantum plane. Here, this is described by matrix configurations which satisfy the commutation relations xA, xB is I times theta AB1. This is just a Heisenberg algebra in any number of dimensions. So this described kind of a flat, quantized phase space, if you like, from this point of view. More interesting example is the fuzzy sphere, which is described as follows. We have three emission matrices, which are some rescaling of these matrices, which are n times n irreducible generators of SU. So the n-dimensional representation of SU2, you know these guys. You have three matrices, so here A goes from 1 to 3. And that is now, that is in some sense close to this picture because that really describes a spherical submanifold in three-dimensional target space, and so on and so forth. So these are just prototypes. In the following, think of them as being more generic. Okay? I don't want to describe things more in detail here. It's just to get some vague picture. Okay, now, what is now a matrix model? So matrix models are actions which govern such matrix configurations. So I will look at specific types of matrix models, of course, and what type of matrix model. I look at Young-Mills matrix models. They have a certain motivation, but let me just write it down. So they are given by an action for such matrix configurations. And there will also be fermionic matrices typically. And the action is given by the trace of, so what can you do? If you have some matrices, you can take the commutator, xA, xB, and you can square it. So let me write it out explicitly. You contract the indices, and now the target space metric eta comes into play. So this is one piece of structure which you have to add by hand. And it goes like that, A prime, eta BB prime. And then there is a fermionic term, which looks like psi bar gamma A X A psi, and that's it. So again, so it takes as configurations, such matrix configurations, so sets of emission matrices. This is kind of obvious. You just take contract the commutators, and that these are fermions. That this will play an important role because for two reasons. First of all, we need to have supersymmetry, as you'll see later. And of course, we want to have matter, so this is where matter will come from. So specifically, these are going to be, and now let me be specific. So there is all kinds of, you can write this down in any dimensions in principle and so on and so forth. But there is one matrix model which is special, and you actually have to use this one, otherwise you have big problems. And the one specific matrix model you should use is the so-called IKKT matrix model in this context, which is also known as type 2B matrix model. And that is the case where you have 9 plus 1 dimensional target space. So it means you have 10 Hermitian matrices and you have a Minkowski metric in this virtual target space. And these are Majorana-Weil spinors. So, which means they are Majorana-Weil spinors in 9 plus 1 dimensions whose entries are matrices. So they're matrix valued spinors. And this is the corresponding SO91 Clifford algebra. Okay. And this thing, this action, so this was introduced by, these are four gentlemen, Ishibashi, Kawai, Kitazawa, Tsuchiya. It was introduced in 96. There is a similar, so it was introduced in the context of string theory. It has a lot to do with the string theory, but I will look at it from a totally independent point of view. This action is, by the way, is very simply the dimensional reduction of 10-dimensional super Young-Mills to point. That's the same thing. So it's actually supersymmetric, which is very important, but only indirectly, only if once you start to compute loops. Okay, so that's what I will consider. And in particular, you see, given some matrix configuration, so some kind of a manifold-like situation here, it'll spit you out a number. So it weights different geometric configurations. Therefore, it is a geometric action from this point of view. Moreover, this action obviously prefers almost commuting matrix configurations. So it prefers, let me say just vaguely, almost commuting configurations. Which means that the commutator of these matrices is going to be small in some whatever it means. So just vaguely. So it almost commutes, and that is then the case where you can replace commutators in a meaningful way by Poisson brackets. So where you can expect it makes sense to have a nice Poisson limit. And basically, I will always work in this Poisson limit. So we'll only consider such configurations where there is a good regime, where the semi-classical limit is meaningful. And then you can start to do geometry.
Fixed.
It is fixed, yeah.
So
it is.
We've got the Poisson tensor basically squared with eta.
Exactly. Exactly.
And the second term, you're taking derivatives of the fermion.
This is really the Dirac operator. Yeah.
Well, not quite. It's a term sideways because of the Poisson tensor. So
it is.
Your gamma zero, which wants to be for the time derivative term, is actually for some spatial derivative term because the Poisson.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, very good point. We can discuss this later. But nevertheless, think of this. This really plays the role of a Dirac operator. You're completely right. There is a point, and I will address this later or ask me after the talk how to address that. Yes. Okay, so that's an interesting
metric using the Poisson tensor.
Yeah. It's true. Of course, metric and Poisson tensor, somehow they mix. That's true. And that's an interesting story. So that's the framework. In this sense, yes.
Question. In the approximation you described, do we have n squared degrees of freedom per matrix or n degrees of freedom per matrix?
N square. So Hermitian, it's n square. But yeah, this is actually an interesting question because in somehow the semi-classical regime has only n degrees of freedom, and all, most of them are sort of in the deep quantum regime. So if you talk about the local thing, it's only n, and most of them are actually kind of non-local.
Right. So can you handle the dynamics of the other n?
Yes, that's where supersymmetry comes into play. Only in the supersymmetric case, the non-local stuff will be sufficiently suppressed so that you can think of it in a semi-classical sense. This is actually the deep underlying reason why I have to look at this model. Otherwise, it's completely non-local. And only supersymmetry rescues the semi-classical treatment. This is actually a very, very important point. Because, in fact, there are, of course, matrices. You can also have configurations which are completely non-local, you know, just like strings going from one point to the other. And these are actually open strings. So these matrix configurations can also be kind of, sometimes they're like non-local strings. So that's why it's actually a string theory. So this, if you consider these sort of ultraviolet high energy modes, you'll see it's actually a string-like theory. But in the supersymmetric model, these non-local things are suppressed.
But this still play a role. Do you know enough about this to take this as the definition of string theory?
Yes, this model was proposed as a constructed definition of that to be string theory. And I think this is a very clever thing. It's a non-trivial thing, and I will make some comments in this direction. So in some sense, yes, but I will look at it in a way where you see that the physics is actually quite different from what people usually do in string theory, and that's actually what the message I want to make. For example, the story about compactification is very different.
Very good.
So I will not compactify, and that's the whole point, actually. I will come to that. So this is the setup. And now, of course, if you have an action, the first thing you do in physics, you consider the equations of motion. So what are the equations of motion of this model? Very simple. Let me write them down like this. you just do the variation, you vary all the entries of these matrices, and you get something like, sorry, I hope you can still see it, XA is zero. What is this box operator? The box operator is the matrix analog of the Laplacian, which is defined like that. The double commutator of taking with these matrices, and you thought, no, I made a terrible mistake. You should think of this. So this is a map from matrices to matrices. And think of it as matrix Laplacian. So this is the matrix Laplacian. And you can actually show, if you elaborate, I will elaborate this geometric thing in some more detail, but let me just anticipate the result. This actually corresponds in the semi-classical limit to the metric Laplacian with some effective metric G, and there is a Dilaton factor, and G is the effective metric, which I'll write down in a second. So that's one way how you can extract the physical matrix, the physical metric from the matrix configuration. And I'll make it more explicit in a second. And this semi-classical, of course, is just minus the double Poisson packet. Now let me write it like that. Okay, and now you can start to do propagation. It's a Dilaton. I will explain it in a second. So, a second. Yeah. Okay. So that is how you start to make some. You have a wave equation now, and we'll, of course, now if you make some excitations. So if you excite the background, the excitations, all the fields will be governed by this matrix Laplacian, and then you can start to do interesting physics. You get field theory. So these are kind of on-shell geometric configurations, and it sort of tells you. So the matrix model likes harmonically embedded brains, roughly speaking. And of course, the geometry of these brains is dynamical. That's why it's in some sense it is some kind of gravity, and we'll make it more explicit in a second. Now, the most important question, however, is how do you get 3+1 dimensional physics from a 9+1 dimensional model? Now that's an issue which of course is known in string theory. So how do you get 3+1 dimensional physics? Or space-time.
Can I mention another question? What is your attitude towards divergences? Because you have to go all the way to the limit and goes to infinity to discuss divergences.
I did not understand
you
the question.
You have to go all the way to n goes to infinity to discuss divergences. So what is your attitude towards divergences?
I'll come to that. In this model, this model, I claim, is ultraviolet finite, but only because of maximal supersymmetry and only on 3+1 dimensional backgrounds.
Only because of maximal supersymmetry?
Yeah.
I mean, if you consider finite matrices, there.
Yeah. That's a different story. Okay. So that's a different story. Of course, if n is finite, everything in principle is well defined, and nothing diverges. But that's too cheap. This is too superficial. Sorry. Still, even in the case, so if you let fix n to be some large but fixed number, of course, in principle, it's well defined. But the point is, if you study the model which is not supersymmetric, you will see that the effective physics is completely non local because these non local string states dominate in these loops. And if they dominate the loops, the effective action will be completely non local, and you don't want that. So it has nothing to do with local field theory. What I'm claiming is you can recover local field theory only in the maximally supersymmetric model, because then the local, non-local stuff is suppressed. And then it doesn't really matter if you have n finite or not, because the ultraviolet, it's convergent. In 3+1 dimensions, it's then convergent. So you just take the limit, it's the same. So that's what it should be for physics, for a nice, meaningful definition of physics. So it's actually, all this stuff is quite subtle, and thank you for the questions.
Are you sure you don't want the non-local physics at n at infinity? Are you sure you don't want the non-local physics at n at infinity?
It will be slightly non-local, absolutely. So but it will not be totally non-local, and that's exactly what you need. So there is some non-locality left, and some of this will actually play a role in to get the induced Einstein-Hilbert action, which I will try to explain. But it should not dominate, you know, it should still be approximately local. So for us, we see the world as approximately local, but of course, the point is it would not be completely local. And I think that's exactly the sort of the compromise you need. And I hope that this model does give you this kind of thing. The only chance is to look at the supersymmetric model. Sorry.
Sorry, you don't have psi in the EOM?
Of course, yeah. I drop all the fermions. In principle, there is a contribution from the fermions. Yes. But let me drop this. So I will not have any fermionic background, but in principle, it's there. Yeah. So this is the bosonic background. And now the question is, how do you get three-dimensional space time from this 9+1 dimensional model? There are two possible approaches. The approach number one, which is taken by string theorists, is to compactify. There is a number of proposals starting in the late 97 or so. Basically, they put it on a torus, but I think this, you shouldn't do that, because once you do that, in fact, it'll turn out somehow the matrix model, you have to modify the matrix model by hand, and it loses its nature. It actually turns into a field theory. And there's all kinds of reasons why I don't like that. You introduce infinitely many degrees of freedom per volume and so on and so forth. So I will not do that. You can do it, and then you really make contact with standard string theory, including issues like landscape and so on, probably. So that's what I want to avoid. And I claim there is another way. That's the main message, actually, I want to do is by choosing a non-trivial vacuum, which means spontaneous symmetry breaking. That's what I would like to discuss. Choose a non-trivial vacuum, which means basically spontaneous symmetry breaking. Spontaneous symmetry breaking from SO91 to SO31 or whatever. And this is like in field theory, you know, you assume that in the vacuum of this theory, you have, let me take the vacuum expectation values of these matrices. And then I assume that this defines you some nice background where only some of these matrices are non-trivial and the others are trivial. So for example, 3+1 matrices will be non-trivial and the remaining 6+1 will be basically zero on average. And sort of the claim or the hope is that there exists such stable or metastable vacua in this model which have this feature. And that's what I will consider. And of course, that's a deep question. I mean, strictly speaking, that's a non-trivial, non-perturbative thing. And there are some people who actually put this on large computers and simulated. There is some evidence that something like this happened, but it's not yet conclusive. I will just take this as a hypothesis. I will consider explicitly such 3+1 dimensional backgrounds. And I can, you know, you can look at perturbative stability of such things, and that seems to be okay. So at weakly coupled cases, such backgrounds are consistent, and that's what I will consider. And then you don't have to modify the matrix model. It really remains a matrix model. It kind of has finer than many degrees of freedom per unit volume, and that's what you want.
When you say vacuum, do you just mean state, or is there some sense in which such a thing could?
Yeah, okay, what do you mean by that? What I mean here is I should quantize this model, and in fact, this will be done. I will do it in a second, and then this will be hopefully clear, yes. So, So let me assume that this happens. And then I claim that, so let me assume that this is one of these matrix configurations which correspond to a 3+1 dimensional geometry. So let me assume that this corresponds to some 3+1 dimensional quantized symplectic brain. Then I claim that the effective physics you get on such a background is actually 3+1 dimensional, and you don't have to worry about the remaining dimension. The reason is the following. Wasn't there another black spot somewhere? At this one I cannot move, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let me then do it like that. Okay. So now, to convince you that the effective physics is four-dimensional, you look at the following. So let me assume that this is irreducible. And by the way, we will call such backgrounds brains. I will use the word brain, just like in string theory. And these really are brains, as in string theory. It's a good word. And now let me consider such a brain, which is three-dimensional and irreducible. That means that you can think of these configurations. If these are really, these are kind of large matrices, and they sort of have a structure in a suitable, you know, in a suitable basis, they will be dominated by diagonal entries. They have some off-diagonal stuff, otherwise they would be commuting. But sort of it tends to be zero as you go far away from this diagonal. So that's roughly speaking the structure of almost commuting matrix configurations like Meyer-Weil quantum plane and so on and so forth. Now, let me consider fluctuations around such a background. So fluctuations, which means you just add the most general fluctuation, and let me call a fluctuation A. So this is now, in fact, so this is the background and this is the full matrix. And I will stick this into the matrix model. Now, the pole point is these are most arbitrary matrices. So they live in the space of matrices acting on a Hilbert space. But we have just seen that this space of matrices, you should think of it as a quantized space of functions on M. So all of these matrices can be written as functions of X. So they are explicitly 3+1 dimensional functions. On the 3+1 dimensional brain. So the point is
little x is a thing on the left hand side, not on the right hand side. You seem to be mixing.
Yeah, yeah. Right, yeah, yeah. I switch from one to the other because I assume that I'm in a semi-classical regime where I can replace the capital X by the little x. So I will always sort of I'll do this very cavalier. Yeah.
So little x same as x bar.
Yeah, yeah. So x, yeah, the x bar. Right? Yeah, yeah, this should be x bar. Yeah, yeah. You're right. This should be a capital X here. Sorry. Yeah, this is just notation. But the point is, so the most general fluctuations can be written here as functions on this 3+1 dimensional brain, which means there is nothing which is radiating off this brain. So in string theory, of course, people always have the issue when you put the brain, sort of they always consider gravity in target space, which is 9+1 dimensional, and there is always issue with, you know, things are propagating in the bulge. In this setup, there is nothing propagating in the bulk a priori. You can create things in the bulk, but that's a non-perturbative thing. So you would have to create something which moves away from the brain. You would have to make this a block matrix configuration, where one block is the background and the other block is an object which is then free to move in target space. But that's a highly non-perturbative process. At the perturbative level, nothing is propagating off away from the brain, which is why you really get three plus one dimensional physics from this kind of model in that approach, provided the theory is weakly coupled, which I assume, and you can sort of assume that. So that's the most important message, actually. And now we can start to analyze what's the physics of these perturbations. They'll tell you what is the effective gauge theory on the brain. So I said gauge theory, which means there is, of course, a gauge symmetry, which I forgot to write down here. The most important fact of matrix models is, of course, the gauge invariance, which means you have a symmetry XA going to U inverse XA. That's an obvious symmetry of this model, and it extends to the fermionic matrices. And that will play the role of a gauge symmetry. Why? Because U is the most general unitary operator, which on the background can be written as an x-dependent unitary phase. So it's really, this really turns into the local gauge symmetry on this brain. And we can make this much more explicit, and I will do it to some extent. So let me now look at the quadratic action in the fluctuations. What does it mean? So let's plug this into the matrix model and expand it to quadratic RNA to see how what's the effective propagator, what's the effective metric. So the second order term in this kind of thing takes the form. You have a trace of the leading, the most important term is this one, XA. Now I'll drop the bar, but so X is the background, A is the fluctuations, AB, XA, and contraction of indices up and down is always done with eta, so there's no mystery here, AB, and there is some extra terms. There's of course cross terms, but yeah, it's not important at the moment. That thing, Now to simplify life, let me simply consider, now I need an extra blackboard. So I claim that this kind of thing leads to a Young-Mills gauge theory. So non-commutative type of Young-Mills gauge theory on this brain. So in 3+1 dimensions. And this is basically, this is a story of non-commutative gauge theory, which is well known if you work on it, and probably is not so fancy anymore these days, so nobody knows it, but it's a straightforward story. All of these kind of things end up being Young-Mills gauge theories, and you have, what are the gauge transformations? Gauge transformations are easy. U inverse X plus AA U. This you can write as X plus fluctuations. Now the fluctuation is, okay, now let me make some space. The point is now you get the inhomogeneous transformation law for gauge transformations for free. Namely, it looks like it's basically, okay, U inverse AU plus U inverse commutator X A U. And if you look at these things in detail, this is something like theta A B del B, very roughly speaking. So you see this thing, you get the inhomogeneous transformation of gauge fields on this background. So you automatically get a Young-Mills gauge theory. But let me focus on this quadratic term, because this is, of course, this is where the metric is hidden. So to extract the metric explicitly, let me write this term in some more detail. And now I really need a new blackboard, so I have to erase something. But I'm not allowed to use this one. I'm not allowed to use this one because it's not transmitted.
You have an eraser there. It's not transmitted. The camera is blocked on these two.
So which one should I erase? Let me erase. You remember that? Do I need it? I don't know. Okay, probably I won't have time to go into details here, so I can just as well erase it. But you can ask me later about details. This doesn't work very well. In Europe, we do this differently. Okay, so let me elaborate the effective metric here. By the way, how much time, when should I stop? And to be honest. So.
You still have 20 minutes.
So it's really, okay, 20 minutes, fine. So let me elaborate. Let me, for simplicity, replace these guys by this generic matrix phi. Let me call it phi, then let's just drop some of the indices, then it becomes more transparent. And then, so the quadratic action, which governs all these fluctuations in this model, has the following form. The trace of commutator xA phi, xA phi. So let me elaborate that. Let's go to the semi-classical limit. Then the trace becomes the integral with a symplectic volume form. So this is the symplectic volume form in the semi-classical limit. And then commutators become, for some practice, there is a minus. Okay, xA phi, xB, let me be explicit, phi, eta, AB. Now, what is this commutator? What is this Poisson bracket? So the Poisson bracket of XA acting on anything, you can write as, well, this is a vector field, obviously. Poisson bracket acting in some ways a vector field. Let me call this. This is the frame, A mu m. Okay, this is my definition of a frame. That's what comes out from here. And it's a meaningful thing because then you can write it like that. So then this is integral omega e a mu e b mu eta a b del mu phi del. Okay. Now, obviously, this is the effective metric, and you recognize the standard thing. So you can write this. Now you fill a little bit with the scalar factor. So I claim after one more step, you can write it in the standard form. Square root g, there is an effective metric, g mu nu, del mu phi, del mu phi. And what is the effective metric? Sorry, I usually use the capital G. Don't get confused, it's just a spleen. So g mu nu is, of course, well, there is this e a mu e b mu at a b. And there is a, you have to put the conformal factor, which is a dilaton. Let me call it dilaton.
But that's not a separate degree of freedom.
No, of course. It's a combination of it's basically encodes the symplectic volume form. So the formula is the following. So rho square, you're completely right, is this is the symplectic density times the determinant of the frame. And what is this? So the symplectic volume form is rho m d. Let me go to four dimensions, d4x. Let me assume that the brain is triple one dimensional. Then you can write the symplectic volume form like that. And then you get this thing. You're right. It's not an independent degree of freedom. It's just some combination of the stuff. So, but the point is now this really has a standard form of covariant kinetic term, and you can read the effective action. So this is the effective action. It's I don't cook it up, it's just a result. Sorry, effective metric. This is effective metric. So the statement is that all fluctuations in this model are governed by this effective metric because all fluctuations come, the quadratic term always has the structure in a metric model. So that's why it's a universal metric, and that's why you have to interpret it in terms of gravity. And of course, it's dynamical because the whole thing, the brain is dynamical. The question is, okay, is it a reasonable gravity? And to cut the, because I don't have much time, let me just now just give a little. So you want to analyze now the dynamics of this effective brain, of course, of this effective metric, which is of course also governed by this matrix model. Now, it turns out a good structure to do that is to introduce not the Levi-Civita connection, but the Weizenberg connection. Levi-Civita somehow is not natural here, but the Weizenberg is, because the Weizenberg connection is the following very simple thing. So at the semi-classical level, you can do it. You just declare these frames to be covariantly constant. This means there is no curvature, but there is torsion. So everything is encoded in the torsion of this Weizenberg connection. And the torsion of the Weizenberg connection is the following thing. This will need. So there is a torsion which has the form A, B, mu. And it turns out, in the end of the day, you can write it nicely in terms of Poisson bracket. This is why it's a good thing. This is nothing but the commutator of this background, sorry, the Poisson brackets of this background, A, B. And now you just choose any local coordinates. Okay, that's a result. The torsion of the Weizenberg connection of such a thing, of a frame which comes from Poisson brackets, can always be written like that. And that's why it's a natural object in this matrix model framework, because you always have to deal with commutators. And it is well known from the context of Bailey parallel gravity that you can write things like the Einstein-Siebel reduction nicely in terms of distortion, and that's what will happen.
So technical, important point is that, I mean, the number of index A is 10 dimensional and U is 4 dimensional.
Yeah. That's very good. You're completely right. You're completely right. So yeah. So let me. Yeah. You're completely right. There's a technical point which I put under the carpet, because otherwise it gets too technical. You can handle that. And the simplest way to handle it, let's just assume that this brain is embedded locally in the flat way. You can still have a non-trivial metric, by the way. And then you just restrict these indices to be parallel. But you don't have to do that. You can really, you just use this local done projection, basically. So effectively, you can always define that it's effectively as the dimension of the brain, and which means sort of the transversal directions.
Okay. What about the metric? Because Roman is zero now, and that
is the metric is definitely by construction. This metric is really only triple as one dimensional. You see, these indices mu and nu, they are space-time indices, so they're triple as one dimensional indices. You're right that
it's more about,
but the frame, of course, the frame you can have. You have 10, the frame consists of 10 vector fields. You're completely right. So this is unusual, but still it's okay. So it's kind of it's a generalized frame, really. But you can think of it locally, you project. So the rank of the frame is always 4. That's the point. So these extra dimensions are kind of immaterial, and you can handle that, actually. But this formula is completely correct. Even so, the indices AB go from 1 to 9, and the indices mu nu go from 1 to 3, and that defines a triple plus 1 dimensional metric. And you can actually always, you have to modify this thing with some projector, you can always do this. Okay. These are technical points, let me not spend too much time. So you have these structures, and now you can talk about gravity. And to get, so the point is, if you now look at the dynamics of this metric, of the effective metric in the classical matrix model, you get something interesting. You actually get
The D is a long vector field. So is it a 10-dimensional vector field or 4-dimensional vector field?
Which one?
So now you have two space time, which is 10 dimension.
So
when you take your definition of like the connection, is the D is mu or D?
Okay, so this is a 4-dimensional vector field. The Weizenberg is really it's only on the submanifold. It's really it's a D.
Downstairs.
Yeah, it's a mean. Yeah. Effectively, it's that. But you can always. So this is the object which you can always write down. Of course, here the matrices are unrestricted, and that is essentially that contains the information of the tangential Weizenberg connection. So I'm looking at the tangential Weizenberg connection, if you like. And I claim that there is a nice way to do that, even if your frame contains more vectors, as long as the frame has only rank D. So that's technical. I can show you some in detail, but I don't want to do this here. So what I wanted to say is, if you now study the effective pre-gravity arising from the classical model, it's still kind of interesting because it's actually at the linearized level, you get Ricci flat geometries. This is kind of remarkable. Let me write it up. But it doesn't work at the nonlinear level. Where can I write it?
Good.
So let me call the pre-gravity. That's the theory which arises from the classical matrix model. So classical means no quantum corrections. So that one interesting thing is you get still, so you have metric fluctuations are actually Ricci flat, but only at the linearized level.
So, because it's a class metric.
That's another point. Yeah, you're completely right.
So, what, you know.
Okay, so you're completely right. Very good. So, if you use these sort of simple minded 3+1-dimensional symplectic manifolds, of course. This is not the most general metric. There are two ways out of this. First way is, if you consider manifolds with non-trivial embedding in 10-dimensional target space, then you can get the most general effective 3+1-dimensional metric. But this actually, I don't really like that. So what I will do in the last 5 minutes, there is a different class of quantum spaces which have an internal hidden S2 fiber, and then you get actually the most general 3+1-dimensional matrix directly, even with a flat embedding in the matrix model. So these are the covariant quantum spaces, which I will write down the formulas in the end. And that's the setting which I think is best, because then you have the most general metric fluctuation, you get volume preserving diffuse, the general, most general volume preserving diffuse, but you will also get the price to base, then you get a higher spin theory. So here the metric is restricted. You're in some sense right. And so that's one issue. The other issue that you don't really get, this is not Einstein gravity, and it's probably not physical enough. So what you have to do is consider loop computation. So quantize the model. And here I will only sketch it. And you can do it explicitly at one loop, assuming the weakly coupled regime, and then you can actually compute. So the one loop effective, how do you quantize it? Of course, what you have to do is you integrate over all matrices and over all fermions e to the I s of x. And then you couple to currents and so on, and at the end of the day, you get an effective action. Effective action depends on the background. You can do this explicitly on one loop. One loop, of course, a Gaussian integral, you can really do that. And if you do that explicitly at one loop, sorry, this is a gamma now. Where's my eraser? I lost my eraser.
I think it's on the top. Okay.
So if you compute the one loop effective action, and you can do this even in the supersymmetric case, this includes an Einstein-Hilbert drum. In the following form, what you get is the contraction of a torsion. Basically, something like that. So, and that is actually corresponds to the Ricci thing, the usual thing. Plus, there is an extra term, which is, it turns out there is something like a gravitational axion, which comes from the totally antisymmetric part of the torsion. So you get some, yeah?
Not only that, if the cosmological constant doesn't vary, it shows up in that term as well. If you let the cosmological constant vary, it shows up in that torsion term. The real is that it shows up in that torsion term as well.
Did you understand the question? I just.
He's talking about the cosmological constant.
Yeah, I'll come. Okay, cosmological constant is another thing. Okay, I'll write down in a second. Yeah, of course, there is a cosmological constant term, but this is actually also very interesting because. Okay. Plus, so the vacuum energy actually has a slightly different form from the cosmological constant term, which is very interesting because there is a symplectic volume form. So the vacuum energy is actually governed by the symplectic volume form and not by the Riemannian one. There is some extra stuff. Also, there is a dilaton, and now there is an. What is the Newton constant here? So if you do the computation. The Newton constant. So this thing works only if you assume a slightly more interesting background. Namely, you assume that the background has the form M31 times product with some compact fuzzy space still embedded in this target space. So it turns out to get gravity, so to get an induced Einstein-Hilbert action, you need to put fuzzy extra dimensions, which is done in exactly the same framework, and you have Kaluza-Klein modes here. And on this one, you get a Kaluza-Klein scale, lambda kk, and that sets the gravitational constant, actually. So,
earlier we threw out the extra dimensions by kind of collapsing things.
Yeah, but it's a very different story. No. It's not the same thing. So this is not a compactification like string theorists do. This is a finite matrix. So this is something like a fuzzy sphere, which is still a submanifold in a target space. It's a completely different story. This is fine because you have still only finitely many degrees of freedom per volume, and all the one loop stuff goes through. It's still finite. What string theorists mean with compactification is something totally different. And then it becomes pathological, in my opinion. So, yeah, it turns out to get gravity, you have to put this. This gives you a scale, Kaluza-Klein scale, and that's the scale actually which sets the gravitational constant. What is it? Yeah, it's basically. Something like that. So the gravitational constant is set by this thing, and you have to assume that there is a stable background like that. But in fact, then the vacuum energy sort of tells you, of course, depends on these scales, and sort of the preliminary calculations which I did, which are, by the way, I should give some literature, shows that this thing, the radius of this is actually stabilized at one loop. So I think it makes sense to, this is a meaningful and self-consistent assumption, and that's the whole thing. So if you have the structure, then the vacuum energy, you get something like that. So this has a slightly different structure from cosmological constant because it's not just the Riemannian volume. It's essentially the symplectic volume, which is something rigid. So I hope that means there is, of course, a large vacuum energy, but it does not mean it's not a cosmological constant. Now, this is tricky because there is a dilaton and you have to really work out what it all means. But I'm kind of convinced that in this setup, the large vacuum energy does not destroy your 3+1 dimensional geometry. And that's, of course, the kind of the most important message. But this needs to be worked out in more detail. But I think it's meaningful because the symplectic volume, of course, is basically quantized. So there's nothing, it doesn't do anything.
So the dilaton doesn't acquire.
Yeah. No, the dilaton. Let's see. I think they're not the dilaton. I think it also acquires kinetic term. Yeah. If you work it out somehow, let me give you some literature actually. So these things are worked out in various details. Yeah, the dilaton also has a kinetic term. So this gravity, this one loop computation, you can find it. Where do you write this stuff? I don't have space. I wrote this down. Yeah, here it is. So that's a short letter. 2110.03936. And there is a pedagogical introduction, hopefully, to this framework, which I wrote somewhere. Where do I have space? So introduction. And there is, of course, that's where you find the other references. Where is it? The covariant quantum spaces, I'm afraid. Yeah, I just have to say it in. Escaped again. So this introduction thing is 1911.03162. And finally, to address Laurent's question, there is a good answer to that, which means the good quantum space times are actually slightly more tricky structures. They are bundles over space time, and there is nice explicit examples for that. So covariant quantum space times, 1 minute. Quantum spacetime. So the whole framework works in the same sense if I replace the brain with a bundle, which is an S2 bundle over spacetime. And explicitly, this is actually just Twistor space. This is kind of quantized Twistor space. Let me write it, kind of a non-compact version of CP3. Then the nice thing is that here on the spacetime part, the expectation value of the Poisson bracket is zero. So there is no explicit Lorentz breaking. This is an issue which you always have here. If you have a symplectic manifold, you have a Poisson tensor which breaks Lorentz invariance. So that's dangerous. This setup, this problem disappears. And you get all the degrees of freedom that are from the metric. Moreover, the symplectomorphisms here, they contain all volume preserving diffeomorphisms here. So you get the full gauge symmetry, but you get higher spin modes. And the higher spin modes are harmonics on this fiber. So in the end of the day, you get a reasonable higher spin extension of gravity, which is free of ghosts. So I really showed rather carefully that there are no ghosts here. So I think it's a meaningful theory, and the explicit formula for this fuzzy space time, let me write it down. That's what maybe Laurent wants to see. It has the following form. So the algebra is the following: T mu x mu is I times eta mu times, now there is a parameter, let me call it kappa. Then there is x mu is I times m mu nu, I'll tell you what it is. T mu is minus I, there is some R squared, this I over R squared, some scale parameters, m mu nu, and there is a constraint. The constraint has the following form. And that's the constraint is essential because it kills the ghosts. The constraint looks like that. X mu, T mu, zero is x mu minus t. So this is, I think that's the best candidate for quantum spacetime. And it really comes from an irreducible representation of SO4,2, namely the double dons ones. So algebraically, you start with this irreducible unitary representation of SO4,2. You get this algebra. That is a solution of the matrix model. You have to put a mass term actually, but nevertheless. And then on this background, you get the higher spin gauge theory in Minkowski signature with a healthy fluctuation spectrum. So this is just the Lie algebra of SO4,2 rewritten, and the kappa parameter is one of the extra parameters, one of the extra generators here. That's probably a place where I should stop. So the qualitative stuff goes through. It's a bit more technical, but then you have no explicit Lorentz violation. And I think this is an interesting spacetime. It's actually a Friedman-Robertson-Walker cosmology with a big bound. So there's lots of interesting stuff, but I don't have time, so let me stop here. Sorry.
Yeah, could you explain the difference between this x that you attach and what happens in string compactifications?
The difference between what and string
compactifications?
Okay, good. Yeah. So this is really just, as I say, think of it as a compact, this is like a fuzzy sphere. So you have a 3+1 dimensional spacetime, dimes a fuzzy sphere, and the whole thing, this is a 6-dimensional brain embedded in target space. What string theorists do, they really change the target space, so they make it into a torus. And the way to do it algebraically is you have to introduce an extra Hilbert space, which is infinite dimensional. And in the end of the day, what you get is a field theory. So it's not a matrix model anymore. They have to put some constraints in this matrix model and so on and so forth. So it's technically, it's a completely different thing. And then all this story that I told you doesn't work anymore because one loop, I think it would diverge, as simple as that. So, but putting a compact extra factor in the brain doesn't change any of the things which I told you. So that's still within the same framework because this carries finitely many degrees of freedom. It's like a fuzzy sphere. So that's something which is technically under control, and that makes sense here. So this is the whole brain.
Other question by students?
So just to clarify the symplectic form that you've written down over there, that's obtained from the Poisson bracket, is it related? Because
Yeah. So the Poisson bracket is the one which arises from the symplectic form, absolutely. It's a usual story, it's just the inverse tensor, basically.
Yeah, but then you need our A and mu to be the same dimension, right? Or the
No. Well, you see, these are functions on the manifold. So we have this manifold embedded in target space. These are functions. So for any functions, you can define the brain. This is not a tensor. This is just a Poisson bracket between functions. You can always, it always makes sense.
A and mu.
No, no, no. This goes from 1 to d. And this goes from 1 to little d. And it's consistent. It just, yeah, it's fine. The symplectic structure has rank d, therefore only d of these vector fields are independent. So they have more linearly dependent vector fields in this frame. So the frame is degenerate in some sense. That's what it means, but it makes perfect sense.
What do you call the symplectic structure when the Poisson bracket is?
No, So the on the brain, it is a symplectic structure. The brain is a symplectic manifold, but not target space. Brain has a symplectic structure of rank d. That's what I work here. And that I can invert it only on the brain. It doesn't make any sense to talk about symplectic structure in target space. It doesn't exist.
Right, you're doing a projection, essentially.
You can think of it as a projection in target space, yeah. So from target space point of view, it's really a projection. But it happens automatically, and I don't have, this is not done by hand. This is what comes out if you do fluctuations here. Yeah.
Okay.
So everything lives on target space. That's the point.
Yeah, so the follow-up is that you have a symplectic structure, you have like a metric, right? Induced metric, then you have a Kähler manifold, right?
Whether or not it's Kähler is a different story. Some of them are Kähler, some of them are not. But you're right. I mean, Kähler, of course, is the nicest case because then you have some particularly nice formulas for the quantization and so on. Yeah. But it doesn't have to be Kähler, and I have examples which are definitely not Kähler.
There's two metrics and the Planck structure forming one into the other.
By the way, the effective metric has nothing to do with the metric for the Kähler structure. They're totally different things.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
Hello, everyone. There's a question.
Anyway, I'm around for this week, so you can ask me.
Yeah. You're saying from the end of the week, right?
Till the end of the week, yes.
He has a question.
So, can you hear me?
No, I can hear you, yes.
Good. So you work in an approximation where all the matrices, all the degrees of freedom are commuting in the limit n goes to infinity. And this has a name, I don't remember the name, but this has a name. These are all matrices which have a fixed norm. They commute in the limit n goes to infinity. So you're leaving out of the dynamics, roughly speaking, n squared degrees of freedom, which don't commute as n goes to infinity. Is that right? These are all your sources of non-locality.
Okay, I'm not sure if I understood the question. So the way I understood the question is, so yes, I only work with commuting objects here because I restrict myself to the low energy sector of the theory, and then I can treat the matrices of computing, which is only a little part of their degrees of freedom. You're completely right. There is much more degrees of freedom which are non-local, but they don't play a significant role in the supersymmetric case because then the loop is convergent. I don't know if this answers.
Well, let's drop the supersymmetry for a moment. If we drop the supersymmetry, then the non-local, these non-local terms that you drop dominate. Do you agree?
Yeah. Then the effective action becomes non-local very strongly.
Right. It's something like a double manifold thing. Right?
Yeah. In fact, you get the bilocal field theory. What you get is a bilocal field theory. You can make this actually explicit. Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes. And so we've been following this all the way through. And the question is, in the end, what's the meaning of the algebra of matrices that are genuinely infinite-dimensional?
Yeah, I think that the general meaning of the algebra of matrices, they are open strings. So that's the best way of looking at it. They're open strings which connect two points on the brain. This is sort of the best organization of the full algebra. That's why it is a string.
I don't care what you call it. The question is there a well-defined algebra of genuinely infinite by infinite-dimensional matrices? Because that's where all the non-local degrees of freedom are.
Again, I didn't acoustically understand.
The question is, the degrees of freedom that you leave out of your analysis, do they make sense? If you leave them out completely, then you're only studying a semi-classical limit of your theory.
You're ignoring the things that dominate theory. I think that's the essence of it.
Yeah, that's right. There are the non-local sector, which is there, which is in the matrix algebra. It's actually dominated by the non-local object. You're completely right. But as I explained to you, for a reason, I actually don't have to consider it in this case. But in general, it's there, yes. And in general, this is the reason why generic matrix models don't work. Generic matrix models will not give you anything like a local field theory. This is why the subject of non-commutative field theory has sort of died. That's the reason. This is ultraviolet infrared mixing. This is precisely ultraviolet infrared mixing.
Yes, but aren't we interested? What I don't understand is if you take the attitude you're taking, you know you're not going to get anything past an effective local field theory. By kind of field theory.
Again, I have not understood the question. I'm sorry.
Okay. Aren't you interested in the parts of the theory which are non-local?
Yeah. Well, I'm not interested in them if from the point of view of non-local physics. So for the moment, I'm not too interested in them, but it's there, you're right, and it plays a role which is not visible at low energy. So my statement is there is an effective separation of degrees of freedom in the supersymmetric case. You have this huge non-local sector, but it's not significant at low energy. That's all I'm saying. in the supersymmetric case.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
A last question.
So I'm kind of unclear on what you mean about the stuff with T's here. Did you change your original model?
No, it's the same model. So these are, think of them as momenta, this is space time, and the solution, the matrix background is actually given in terms of the T's. But it doesn't matter, you still have the same picture. So in some sense, you actually technically have now the TAs, which are the matrix background, and they, you can consider them as embedding of this bundle in this model. Then all the story goes through with a slight complication that you can now organize things in terms of functions on the base manifolds, taking higher spin, which are possibly higher spin valued. So I did not explain this, but so the structure is exactly the same. It's just a higher dimensional degenerate version, degenerate embedding of this thing in terms of the momenta rather than the position. So I did not explain it on purpose because it's completely confusing. But in the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It still works. Sorry.
Yeah, it works.
I claim that it works.
I don't believe you.
Look at the papers. It's there is a couple of papers. But yeah, this is another part of the story which we can discuss.
Okay. Thanks a lot for all the questions and thanks for your nice talk and thanks for all the time.